Hello and good morning, you guys. How are you guys doing today?
Good, good, good.
Good.
What an amazing time in history for it to be honored. Trouser Press was such a major part of my 44 years of broadcasting because you were my go-to. You were who I trusted.
Thanks, yeah.
Hope we earned your trust.
One of the things that I've always loved about Trouser Press is how much we did trust you. So I would love to know what it was like to be a part of that team, because it really did take a real team to make that happen.
It was a very isolated existence. We had an office on Times Square. You know, we kind of went in every day and did what we did, and didn't really know what impact we were having or who it was mattering to. You know, we would get letters to the editor. We get a couple of subscription orders every day. But basically, it was kind of like being in a bunker and just sort of like shooting the magazine out to the world and not really knowing whether it mattered to anybody. I mean, it was only after the magazine ended in 1984 that we really kind of got a full view of how many people had really appreciated and responded and been affected by what we did. I mean, I still get people, you know, I meet people and go like, oh my God, you did Trouser Press. Wow, that was great when I was growing up, you know, and like, these were people that we never knew existed when we were doing it.
Yeah, see, and that's that relationship that I love. And that, you know, like when it comes to alternative music, because, you know, once alternative music really made its way to radio, all of a sudden the alternative was being played every 45 minutes. And that's what I loved about Trouser Press, is that you guys were the alternative, but you stayed the alternative.
Yeah, well, we started when there was no real chance of the music that we liked getting any real exposure in America. And that was sort of our mission, was to write about bands that, you know, and artists that just weren't really getting a lot of coverage in you know, American mainstream media. You know, we did cover a lot of big bands, like, you know, Dave interviewed Jimmy Page and things like that. But, you know, we put a lot of classic, what are now classic rock bands on the cover. But, you know, when the new wave happened, you know, we jumped right in with both feet and started covering, you know, bands that had one single out of like Leicester, England, or something like that.
How important was your connection to college radio stations? Because they seemed to be that one place where these bands could be heard.
We tried.
I was a program director at a college radio station. I think we both did radio.
Yeah, well, a little bit. But I mean, we tried to kind of market our magazine to college radio, but we weren't very successful. You know, kind of took like College Media Journal coming along to kind of really make that an industry that could actually have an impact.
Right. So when it comes to punk rock versus post rock, because I'm talking with a lot of new age punk bands today, is there a difference between the two, or is today's music pretty much pop punk?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a lot of pop punk around, but I think it's kind of mutated. I mean, there was kind of one moment when like Green Day and Blink 182 and, you know, and the Muffs and a couple of bands like that were all doing the same kind of music at the same time. But I don't really know if there's a lot of bands like that anymore. I still go back to my old Queers albums.
Yeah, I was with Johnny Rotten a couple of times, and one of the things that he always reminded me, he says, I'm not a punk band, I'm a blues band. Do you believe that it went into that area?
No. He's a liar. A hugely talented and influential figure, but he's a liar.
Can you believe that 50 years have gone by? Because it feels like that it was just yesterday.
It doesn't feel like it was yesterday. But Dave and I look at each other a lot and go, like, I can't believe how long it's been that we've known each other, that we've done this stuff. You know, I mean, Dave and I met in high school in 1969.
Wow.
You know, and so, you know, that's a long time to be best friends with somebody.
Wow. Yeah, you really grew up in that glam rock generation, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we did.
Wow. I mean, because I wish most of today's listeners would understand that, even if they're, you know, they're asking Alexa or even going to iHeart to pick up these glam rock bands, the real story of these bands and why they did what they did.
They were funny because, like, you know, they were pop bands, but they were pop bands that were transgressive. You know, I mean, Bolan and Bowie and Sweet and Slade and Roxy Music, none of them were pop bands in the sense of trying to be, you know, loved in this traditional way that, like, a Taylor Swift is loved. You know, I mean, they certainly weren't going out of their way to be, you know, acceptable or normal or, you know, mainstream.
And friendly. Yeah.
They were trying to be as weird and as crazy as they could possibly be. And it really, it appealed to us, you know, because that's kind of who we wanted to be as well, not necessarily dressing up that way, but you know, kind of challenging, you know, the norms and being outside the mainstream. So it felt good to us, and the bands were great. But yeah, it's a little hard to explain that to people now.
Yeah. Writing the articles and collecting the interviews, did you ever think that one day you guys would be the historians?
I think Dave did.
Yeah, I always approached it from kind of a historical perspective. It's kind of what I was interested in. So, you know, I'm happy we ended up there as historical artifacts.
One of the things that makes it easier to do articles in a music magazine is having kind of a through story. And the through story is very easily done if it's history. You know, like if you're telling a story kind of from A to B to C, it's a lot easier than a really complicated kind of like amorphous think piece, you know. And so it's very appealing to do kind of a, this is where they started, this is where they got to, and this is where they're going. You know, so I think history writing for us felt very natural, you know, and we approached a lot of bands from the point of view of like, well, let me just add one other thing. The minute Dave and I discovered The Who, the first thing we did was to try to find out what other albums they had made, you know, which wasn't as easy as it is now because you can go to, you know, discogs.com and just get a list. But in those days, you know, we were like, oh my God, these guys are amazing. What else do they have? And we'd have to go to the record stores and just go through the bins and see what else was there. You know, and so I think we intuitively were historically minded just because we wanted to hear more of the bands that we liked.
Yeah, that was definitely a give us more attitude.
Would you say that reggae is still one of the most misunderstood languages? Only because, you know, the most recent Bob Marley movie opened up my eyes and heart to look even deeper into the purpose of the music.
I think reggae's got a lot of facets to it that haven't really ever been accepted in America. I mean, like dub reggae. You know, like Generation X was doing dub mixes on their singles in before 1980. And I don't think anybody really knew that at the time because, you know, it was so out of character for them, but it had a huge impact on me. I thought that was great.
And XTC did a whole dub album. Their second album was, you know, accompanied by a dub version thereof, which was amazing.
You speak of Frank Zappa, Lou Reed, Brian Ferry, Devo, The Clash. I just remember them as a kid as being those new guys. And now when you look back, you're going, oh my God, they were part of my life. And it's like, that's how important it was for Trouser Press to get into our chapters.
I think we now think of them as the old guys because we're the old guys.
I'm still 16. You stop it. What was the best part of the plan lived out, or did you? It's like we can get a little bit more.
Well, I think we would have liked to have kept going, you know, but for a variety of reasons, it just kind of became impossible. You know, Spin Magazine started like shortly after we ended. Yeah. You know, and they started with, you know, Penthouse money. They had $1 million to start their magazine. We had $60 to start our magazine. And, you know, I think if we'd had $1 million, you know, we would have been going a lot longer. And, you know, I think we could have had this sort of impact that Spin had. Is kind of like Spin became like the alternative magazine in the 80s. And we, you know, we were that, but we stopped. But I think we could have kept going. You know, I mean, it would have been interesting. And certainly the rise of something like Pitchfork, you know, makes me a little nostalgic for like what we were able to do with a whole lot less resources. You know, we would have been just as mean and bitchy as Pitchfork is.
He used the word plan, and there really was no plan when we started, other than like maybe we'll do a second issue. Question mark.
That is so interesting that you bring that up, because I was going to say never once did I ever feel like that you guys were winging it.
We definitely were winging it.
Really? Oh, my God.
Always.
Yeah, we never had a clue. I mean, you know, it was very – we just kind of made it up as we went along. I mean, none of us had worked at a magazine or had ever, you know, basically ever done any real writing before this. And, you know, we just sort of, like, started. It's funny because, like, you know, putting this book together, I look back at a lot of things that we had written, and you know, the early stuff is really awful. I mean, it's just really amateurish, and we had no clue what we were doing, and we were incredibly arrogant about our ignorance. You know, it's like it's always really bad when you're stupid and sure that you're right, which is where we started. But then, you know, we wised up pretty quickly. I think I kind of get, you know, as I read into like, you know, the second, third, fourth, fifth year of the magazine, the writing got to be really good and, you know, really perceptive and confident based on knowledge, not, you know, just attitude.
Wow.
And I think the interviews were always good.
How did you gain the confidence of the musician? Because, I mean, even today, I mean, it's always like, who are you with? How? What is the outreach? How many? What do your numbers look like? Did you guys have to battle that as well?
Not really. We came with equipped with preparation. I mean, what we had was we had a pretty good idea of who the artists we were interviewing were and what they had done. And it gets back to the history thing again, you know, so we could ask intelligent questions. And all in the early days, we interviewed a lot of artists who British artists who didn't really have very much appeal in America. And so the publicists were like delighted that we were keen to interview them. So, you know, like the Trogs would come to town and it's like, you know, why would anybody want to talk to the Trogs other than saying, hey, you did Wild Thing. That was cool. You know, but we were like, holy wow, that, you know, that album you did 3 years ago was really great. And like, you know, weren't you in that other band with that other guy? And it, like, it was a lot easier to earn some respect if you actually knew who they were rather than, you know, you know what it's like, you know, you go on a radio show and the guy goes, I haven't read your book, but tell me what it's like, you know, tell me what it's about, you know, and we could go in and say, you know, it wasn't like, oh, I hear you have a new album out, you know, tell us what's in the bio. We could go in and say, you know, that we wanted to really talk about the record they made 12 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It always freaked them out, or even today it freaks them out when I start breaking down the music itself.
I don't know that we talk to a lot of artists about their lyrics, Dave.
Not a lot of specifics, no. But I think they would have talked about them had we asked about specific lyrics or when we did. I just don't remember that was a big focus.
Yeah.
I once got into it with Elvis Costello over his use of the N-word, which he denied.
Even though it was in the song.
Yeah, it's on Brutal Youth, right? Wow. It's on that album. And he denied it, but like, you know, he said it was no, there's another one. There's another
Oliver's Army.
No, not Oliver's Army. There's another one later on that he denied it. It was I forget what the usage is, but like, the lyrics don't actually printed in the album. It doesn't use the N-word, but like he slurs two words together. It's like Ray Davies with his, you know, fogging up my eyes, you know, that kind of thing.
So like when you release a book like this, Zip It Up, that clears the space for you guys to be creative in other areas. What are you guys doing now that you've got this out here for us?
Well, I'm Trouser Press. I'm running Trouser Press Books, which is the publisher of Zip It Up. So, you know, I've got a lot of other books in the way and books on that we've done, music books. And so we're just trying to kind of keep the ethos of Trouser Press alive through other media.
I work for Premiere Networks. So, you know, I'm kind of involved in music and getting out music information to radio stations every day.
See, we can't shake it, can we? It just stays in our blood. But I thought it was very interesting that you talk about getting the story out there, because in my notes, I go, how could you keep this at 440 pages? There has to be a trilogy or something that's taking place. And you just answered that question.
There's plenty more where that came from.
Isn't that the reason why we've been chosen to be leaders in sharing those stories? Because it's like nothing gets in our way of getting a story and then getting it out there to the people.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I mean, one of the things about choosing the articles for this book was that I kind of focused on the longer pieces, the ones that were, you know, more impactful. Mm-hmm. But there's plenty of short pieces that are really good that we just, you know, we could pull together. You know, we did a lot of like one pagers about new bands that were just starting out that we didn't really have a lot to say about. And a lot of those are pretty interesting. I mean, you know, very early looks at bands that became a lot more important later on.
Like U2.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Boy, good point there. Oh my God. Well, one of the things that I'm so proud of you guys of doing with Trouser Press is the fact that you embrace the evolution of music. And that's why I invite listeners to really take on this book and to study it. Don't just sit there and go through and look for your favorite bands. They've got to experience it.
Thank you. That's a good observation.
Absolutely. Well, please come back to this show anytime in the future. The door is always going to be open for you too.
Well, thank you very much, Errol.
Thanks, Errol.